Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WVUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, the Wall Street Journal published the findings of a new study by the IRS. Here's what it found. America's top 400 taxpayers, saw their annual income more or less double in the last 10 years, and their tax rates fall by half. $214 million average income, average tax rate 18%. Pretty sweet. Compare it to yours. This hour on Point, America's richest, what they earn and what they pay and don't pay in taxes. Later this hour, we'll also talk about the Forbes World's Top Billionaires list just out yesterday from Forbes magazine. But first, joining me from New York is Robert Frank. He's the wealth reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He's also author of Richistan, a journey through the American wealth boom and the lies of the new rich. Robert Frank, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And with us from New Haven, Connecticut, is Michael Gratz. He's professor at Yale Law School and former top official at the Treasury Department under George H.W. Bush. He's also author of 100 Million Unnecessary Returns, A Simple, Fair, and Competitive Tax Plan for the United States. Michael Gratz, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Robert Frank, first to this report that I don't know if the IRS put it out or you guys pried it out. How did it come out, and what does it say about the fortunate 400, the top 400 taxpayers?
Well, you're right. We pried it out as opposed to them releasing it. The last time the IRS released a report like this, it caused a bit of a political firestorm because it showed that people were earning at that point, you know, $70 million just to get into this group of top 400. Today, of course, as you mentioned, the cutoff, the price of admission to get into the top 400 income earnings is $100 million. So they were not anxious to release this report. And one of the stunning things that we found in this report after coming through the numbers was, as you said, the average earnings. Now, we're not talking about net worth. We're talking about average earnings for this group.
That is annual income. Million.
That's right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. 213.9 million.
That's right. And, you know, you think about the fact that most people dream over their lifetime of perhaps earning $1 million or $2 million. You know, we really have reached a new level of wealth creation and personal fortunes when the incomes are averaging $213 million for this top group.
So if you look back 10 years or so or back into the 90s, what kind of income did this same 400 have? Do you have those numbers? Are they out there, Robert?
Yeah, they were roughly half. So if we look back at 1995, the average was a little bit under $100 million for this group. And, you know, the cutoff was somewhere around $50 million or $60 million. So the trend has really been doubling over the past 10 years. And we've seen that also in the population of millionaires. In my own research, I found that the population of millionaire households in America has more than doubled over that same 10-year period. So there are now more than 9 million millionaire households in America.
Of course, it's one thing to be a millionaire household and you know, bully for them, but it's quite another to make $214 million in 1 year.
Exactly. And, you know, and that's still, you know, it sounds like a huge amount to most people. But last year, for instance, we had some hedge fund managers making over $1 billion. One hedge fund manager that we recently wrote about, his income last year was close to $3 billion. So even though this group gives us the top 400, there are outliers at the top that are making far more.
That'll drive your average up in a hurry. Give us a sense of who's in this number. I mean, in fairness, or maybe not, I don't know. Are most of these people who are in the top 400 year after year, or is this people whose ship has come in the year of this accounting and, you know, they blink out and disappear from the top 400 the next year or not?
It's a very fluid group. So the last time the IRS did this survey, they tracked the income earners over a 9-year period, and they found that the recurring rate for these people was about 25%. So 3/4 of this list does not reappear the next year. What's really happening here, who these people are, they're people who have most of them started their own companies and mm-hmm. then sold those companies for a large amount of money. Either they sold them through an IPO in the stock market or they sold them to another company. and they receive what's called a liquidity event.
Mm-hmm. Right.
A liquidity event is when this, you know, giant pool of money lands in your lap for this company that you've started. So that means that once you've sold that company, you're not going to be selling that company again the next year. So, you know, to be fair, these are people who worked a long time for this one liquidity event, and they're not going to come on year after year. So it's not like we have this fixed aristocracy in America that's just getting richer every year. It's a different group, and there are more and more people entering that group every year.
Michael Gratz, how about it then? I mean, is this just the American way? That they worked hard, they built the company, they sold it, they made a pile of money. The American way, or something new, different going on here?
Well, that's the American way, but these numbers are staggering. And it's worth noting, Tom, that the $214 million average is probably low because there's no state and local bond interest in any of these numbers, and that's not taxable.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that income is out of these numbers altogether. So we're talking about a low number at $214 million on average.
And no aristocracy, Robert Frank says, because, hey, it turns over all the time. It's different people. Anyone can play this game.
Well, you know, remember, a quarter of these people are in it year after year, and I think a lot of these people are, these days, private equity managers, hedge fund managers, and people who are managing other people's money. You know, the image of America, the American dream, is that you start a small business and you make it into something that's worth a fortune and you sell it. And I'm sure some of those people are the people in this group. But you get the sense that there are also people who have done that and are making the money year after year. And then there's some people who acquired huge amounts of stock along the way, people like Bill Gates and Microsoft and Warren Buffett and the like, and they're probably in this group.
Now, you know, Americans don't tend to go just for raw jealousy about differences in wealth or income. It just doesn't seem to be part of our sort of a psychological profile. You've been at the Treasury Department. You were there in tax policy under the first George H.W. Bush. Is it a problem when the numbers get so incredibly large, when they're doubled over a decade ago in terms of what the average income of this group? Is it a problem when the tax rate that's being paid has gone from about 30% down to 18%? Or is that just the way it is?
Well, I think it is a problem. I think there's definitely a problem. If you look at the concentration of income even below this group, the people who are doing very well are doing extremely well, and the people who are not doing so well are staying stagnant. And so this is a problem with the way the economy is now working. And the average tax rate has dropped, as you say, from 30% to about 18%. And the reason for that, if you look at the data over this period beginning in 1992, it tracks very closely the rate on capital gains. So the rate on capital gains in the early 90s was 28%. And then during Bill Clinton's presidency, he and the Congress dropped it to 20%. And at that point, this group's taxes dropped from about 30% to a little over 20%, about 22 or 23%. Mm. And then in 2003, Congress lowered the capital gains tax to 15%, and this group's taxes dropped to below 20%, to about 18%. And if you look at the source of their income, capital gains accounts for about 60% of the total income of the group. And so that tells you that a lot of this income is capital gain income, and that's the biggest part of the story, I think.
And, of course, in private equity, there's the issue of what gets to qualify as capital gains and whether it should. Robert Frank, you spent a lot of time for your book, Richest Man, in this world, in this sort of high jet stream. Are people there feeling like the, you know, happy days have come in like crazy over the last half dozen years with these tax cuts? Are they still feeling, we pay too much, we make a lot, and we pay too much?
No, you know, what's fascinating is the change in the mindset of the wealthy just in the past 3 years. You know, 3 years ago, and certainly, you know, 2002, 2003, the wealthy were saying, look, you know, we're building companies, we're making our money ourselves. We didn't inherit it, so give us a break. Of course, supply side at that point was very popular. There was even a move to repeal the estate tax. We remember that the Senate made a push for that. It was unsuccessful. Just in the last 3 years, particularly in the last year, inequality has gotten to be such a problem that really out of self-preservation, the wealthy are coming out now saying, you know what? inequality has reached unsustainable levels. We have to do something. We're willing to pay more if that money is spent on education, healthcare, and infrastructure, the important things. But, you know, the wealthy are now saying, and we've got Warren Buffett and billionaire Bill Gross, people like that saying, look, the wealthy should pay more, because if this keeps going, if inequality keeps where the wealthy are making hundreds of millions of dollars, everyone else's, the median income in America is $48,000. If that keeps going, we have political and economic instability, and no one wants that.
But Michael Gratz, so Warren Buffett says wealthy should pay more. Maybe Bill Gross does too, another billionaire. But do you see a chorus of Americans sort of saying we've got to change this tax policy, or do you see it sticking more or less where it is?
Well, I think it's very interesting, because if you look at the political campaigns, and particularly on the Democratic side, where there continues to be talk of cutting back or raising the taxes on the rich, when they talk about the rich, they're talking about people with $200,000 or $250,000 of income.
It's pretty puny in this company.
That's what I was going to say. That's not this group. This is the super rich. And I think there's a real risk if one looks at this group and then tries to make tax policy for America based on these 400 people. That's how we got where we are in the alternative minimum tax.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about new numbers on America's rich, what they earn, and what they pay and don't pay in taxes. Robert Frank is with us, wealth reporter for The Wall Street Journal. His blog in the journal is called The Wealth Report. He's author of Richestan. Michael Gratz is here as well, professor of law at Yale Law School, was a former top official in the Treasury Department under President George H.W. Bush, author of 100 Million Unnecessary Returns. Let's take a call from Bob in Woodstock, Virginia. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
You had asked opinions, and I wanted to offer mine. I'm a good old-fashioned capitalist. I believe everyone in this country has every right to be an entrepreneur, make what they can. However, at the end of the day, I don't feel there needs to be a tiered system. It should be straight across the board. The man paying, I don't know, we'll just say 25% for the sake of argument, at a $50,000 income, the man making $5 million a year should also pay the same 25%.
So
it should just be straight across the board.
Flat tax. So whatever middle class or lower middle class, you name it, the guy pays, the rich should pay the same.
I don't think you should penalize or tear it up or down either way, just because the scale goes higher.
And what about the super rich paying less than the average guy with household income, $50,000 or something?
Well, I disagree with that. I think it should be the same. If they're paying 18% and the guy making $50,000 to $75,000 is paying $20,000 to $25,000, then yes, I do think that's right.
Or 30 plus. Bob, thanks very much. Michael Gratz, you think a lot about tax policy. You see the way our caller Bob is thinking about it. Just make everybody pay the same. Does that make sense? And does where we are make sense?
Well, Tom, I think there's an awful lot of sentiment in the United States for continuing the progressive tax system that we have. Now, the idea of flat rates has become important in recent years and has developed some political momentum.
But do we really have a progressive tax system if these super rich are paying 18%? That sounds like a good deal to a lot of people I know.
Well, it's progressive in the sense that they had a little over 1% of the income, and they paid about 1 2/3% of the total income taxes.
Okay.
So it's progressive in that sense, although it doesn't count the payroll taxes that the average worker is paying up to $90,000 of income.
Well, that's a pretty big thing to leave out for most people.
It is a big thing to leave out. It's the biggest tax at the federal level for 80% of Americans. And it doesn't take into account the state and local taxes, which also tend to be regressive and burden the lower income people more than the higher income people. So if you looked at all their taxes, I suspect that this group, this 400, are paying a lower rate of tax than most Americans.
Well, 18% certainly sounds like it. Robert Frank, do you, when the I don't know if it's the few or the some super rich who fret about this, Warren Buffett, Bill Gross, when they talk about it, do they want to get back into the, you know, big progressive kind of structure where the super rich pay a lot more in this country? Or are they talking flat tax, or are they talking numbers at all?
They are talking numbers, but there's always a bit of hypocrisy there. I mean, when I was doing my book, Richest Man, I talked to a lot of people who considered themselves advocates of progressive taxes. They were saying, look, you know, the wealthy should be paying more than they do right now because they need to support this country more. And yet when I asked them, okay, do you take deductions on your taxes? Do you establish trust? Do you have an attorney who helps you find loopholes? They all said yes. And they said basically, if there are laws that allow me to cut my taxes, as the wealthy all follow, if there are these laws, then I'm going to take advantage of them. So on the one hand, they're saying we should all pay more. But in their personal life, they're happy to pay less. Warren Buffett, as much as he stood in front of Congress and said, I should not be paying a lower percentage than my secretary, he still pays a lower percentage. And so, you know, until the laws, if and when they ever do change, the wealthy will hire experts to help them around these tax laws. So no matter what you do with tax laws, some people say they'll always find a way around it.
Michael, yes, please.
Let me make an observation about this 400. One of the interesting things in this data is that the share of foreign taxes these people are paying has quadrupled since 1992. Now, it still doesn't affect their overall tax rate. But the point is that international investments and placing their income abroad has become much more common in the 10 or 12 years since the last report was done on these people.
Is that hiding income or?
Well, this is income they're reporting.
Yeah.
But the point is that if we raise our tax rate or our tax rate on ordinary income too high, there will be a real temptation for people like this to put their income in places like Liechtenstein and other places that have bank secrecy laws. And then it becomes very hard to collect the income tax on that money. So I think there is a ceiling because of the globalization of the economy in terms of how high ordinary income rates can go. I keep returning to the problem of capital gains, and you mentioned earlier these private equity folks, and you know that Congress last year talked about the idea of taxing people who are paying tax and capital gains on what essentially is their labor earnings from running private equity funds and hedge funds.
But they get the better rate, the capital gains rate now.
And they're getting a capital gains rate. They should be paying at the ordinary income rate of 35%, and then these numbers might look quite different.
But can we really be bumping up against a ceiling on how much the super rich ought to be paying when net-net it comes out to 18%? I mean, that just doesn't sound like nobody likes to pay taxes, but 18% hardly sounds hyper-onerous, Michael Graff.
Oh, no, we're a long way from the ceiling. I didn't mean to suggest that 18% is the ceiling. All I'm saying is that there is a limit to the ordinary income rate of 35% that you can impose. But you could certainly get this rate back up in the 25 to 30% range, which is where it was a decade ago.
Given where our national deficit is, given what the war is costing, should we be trying to do that as a matter of economic policy or fairness or equity or common sense? Or how do you look at it?
Well, the problem of financing the government is a huge problem. As you know, we've waged a war for the first time in our history, a long war, without paying for it in the form of higher taxes. George Bush, in his first term, enacted a Medicare prescription drug benefit, and that was the first time a new entitlement had been put into the law without paying for it. So we have deficits. We have a huge problem with the alternative minimum tax that's going to affect 50 million people if it's left alone. And we've got an aging population and rapidly growing health care costs, which put pressure on both federal and state governments in terms of their Medicare and Medicaid expenses. So it's clear we are not in a position now where we're paying for what we're spending, and we need to get in that position, and that's going to require certainly higher taxes to some extent, and it's going to require higher taxes on the fortunate 400.
And meanwhile, we've got Warren Buffett now, the richest man in the world. He bumped Bill Gates after Bill Gates sitting up there 13 years. We're going to hear from Forbes magazine in a few minutes about the list they put together globally of the billionaires list. But Warren Buffett at the top, not just of the American national heap, but the global heap. He came out last year. He said he'd surveyed his employees at Berkshire Hathaway headquarters and found that all of his employees, down to the secretaries, paid a higher share of their income to taxes in 2006 than he did. And he is the richest man in the world. Jeff's calling from Buffalo, New York. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hello. I'm a truck driver, so I'm a working-class guy. You know, my thought here, listening to this discussion, is I'm wondering why we're not talking about whether or not the total amount of taxes paid by the rich and the super rich has gone up or down versus, you know, their rate of taxes. And it, to me, it just makes me suspicious when we talk about, you know, Warren Buffett pays a lower tax rate than his secretary. Okay, but what's the dollar amount that he paid compared to his secretary?
Jeff, I take your point. I take it, and it's a very generous point, but shouldn't it be the rate we're looking at? I mean, you know, let's say his secretary makes, I don't know what, she's probably helped decently pay. Let's say she makes 50 grand. I have no idea. Now, if he makes, I don't know what he makes, but he's worth, you know, billions and billions, shouldn't he pay a whole lot more than her? And shouldn't it be the rate rather than the exact dollar amount? Wouldn't that be fair?
I don't know. Maybe he pays, you know, $20 million in taxes, and maybe she pays $5,000. And I just think for the honesty of the discussion and
yeah.
for regular Americans like me to be able to understand it, we have to talk about it in terms of what's the dollar amount and is that going up or is
okay.
that going down?
Jeff, stick with us. Robert Frank, first to you. Jeff is generously willing to say, let's just talk about the dollar amount, not the portion of their income. Does that figure to you? Is that the way it ought to be?
It's a fair point because I think, look, a lot of conservatives argue that the wealthy pay a disproportionate share of the nation's income tax. And so to answer his question directly, this group of 400 people paid $16 billion in income taxes in 2005. Huge amount.
But criminally, they make, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times what Jeff probably makes. So it doesn't.
Absolutely, they do. But just to answer his question, and it is an important number to sort of just throw in the mix here, that $16 billion compares to just $6 billion that they paid in 1995. Also, to throw out a number mm-hmm. that Michael mentioned earlier, they control 1.15% of the income, but they pay 1.65% of the total income taxes. So again, it's not to justify whether the rate is right or whether they pay less or more than you or I, but just to get those numbers out there, they do pay $16 billion in income taxes and they make up 1.65% of the total income taxes paid in America.
Michael Gratz, they make a lot, they pay a lot, but there's still equity issues here, are there not? I mean, should we look at it in a flat dollar term? They're making a lot more than they made 10 years ago.
Well, I really don't understand the argument that we ought to just look at dollars. It seems to me that if a truck driver that just called is paying 20% of his income, then the question is how much is the billionaire paying of his income? Most people would say he should pay a little more than 20% of his income. Everyone, I think, would agree he shouldn't pay any less than 20% of his income. And as I say, I think if you look at state and local taxes, which are regressive, if you count the payroll tax that wage earners are paying or the self-employment tax that the truck driver is probably paying, and you look at the total, this is probably a lower percentage of their income than as Warren Buffett likes to say, than the secretaries and truck drivers of America. So we know that's not fair. And I think the only way you can get at that is to look at percentages, although I understand that the numbers are very large. But, you know, they paid $16 billion, as Robert says, in taxes, but they also had $85 billion in earnings. And this is earnings. This is, I'm going to go back to Robert's point, you know, when you have to have $100 million in income in order to get into a group like this, that's income. And it may be that's income that's been accumulated by people who own a business over more than 1 year. But, you know, even for a lifetime, that's an extraordinary number.
And that's a year, not net wealth. Let me get a call from Spokane, Washington, and Michael. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have a comment, and I'd like to get your guest's opinion on mm-hmm. this. I think that a lot of the unfairness, if you perceive it that way, in the tax code is because it's been disingenuous in how it's been sold to the American people, that lower taxes spur economic growth. Now, even if you believe that, the way that they did the dividend tax shows that that's not what they're trying to do. They're trying to enrich people that are already wealthy. And this is my argument. If they were really sincere about spurring economic growth, they would allow companies to pay dividends with pre-tax dollars. So the company generates cash. They decide whether they invest it and create jobs, or if they don't have investment opportunities, then they pay the dividend. And those people that receive the dividends, who are presumably wealthy, would then pay taxes on them. And they did the exact opposite.
But Michael, let me ask you, I mean, do you really think that higher taxes would be more effective in spurring economic growth? There's a kind of just common sense, lower taxes, higher growth.
I actually agree with your guess. I believe it was the professor from Yale that
yep.
said that there's a reasonable level, and you get to a point where it does actually inhibit economic growth. My argument is just that if you are serious about economic
yep.
growth, you need to do it fairly and make the tax code so that it really does spur investment as opposed to enriching people that are already wealthy.
Michael, thank you. Robert Frank, first to you on this. I mean, again, there's a great kind of generosity among Americans, or just a native comfort with capitalism. And, you know, if it works, they're fine with it. But, you know, Michael's saying it just that may have been the argument, but it doesn't look fairly laid out to him. What do you say?
Well, the argument, of course, by supply-siders is if you raise the taxes on the wealthy, there'll be less incentive for them to create companies to create wealth, and that they'll invest less in the economy. Both of those arguments are tough to support right now because, number one, let's say you raise the tax rate for this group to 25%. So these $100 million a year folks will pay, you know, maybe 5 or 10 million more in taxes.
Okay.
Does that really affect their lifestyle or spending because they're worth 90 instead of $100 million? I don't think so.
But it could be 5 or 10 million they don't put into investing in a new company that would create jobs.
The other point, as you mentioned, is investment. But as Michael mentioned before, a lot of the investing activity by today's wealthy is overseas. And so if we say, okay, well, the wealthy won't invest in this country if we raise their taxes, well, they're investing more and more of their money overseas anyway. So that tax break that we give them may end up benefiting the economy of India or the infrastructure in China, but it doesn't benefit the healthcare system or the education system in America.
Michael Gratz, what do you say? The money's going to run away to investments abroad? And what about the issue of, you know, lower taxes, higher economic growth? That's been the formula that Americans have been presented with, and many have bought it. Have they been right to buy it?
Well, I think they are right to buy the idea that we are and have been, over a long period of time, compared to the rest of the world, a low-tax country. And we should be a low-tax country. And the caller makes an important point when he looks to the corporate tax, which is, I think, one of the key linchpins of the tax system in terms of economic growth. And at the moment, our corporate tax rate is second highest in the world. It's only exceeded by Japan's, and everybody else has been lowering their corporate rate, and ours has stayed the same for a long time. So I think this question really goes to the mix of taxes. What's interesting, if you look around the world, is that the other countries have a value-added tax, which is a sales tax that we don't have.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at new numbers on America's rich, what they earn and what they pay and don't pay in taxes. The Wall Street Journal out with this list of the Fortunate 400. IRS puts it together, but they don't like to talk about it much in public. $214 million annual income to get on this list. That's the average. 400 Americans in that category. And their tax rate has dropped from about 30% in the mid-90s. To about 18% now. While income doubled, tax rate cut about in half. What do we make of this picture at a time of national deficit and war and all the rest? Is this right? The spark we need to keep the economy going? Or is something out of whack here? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. In just a minute, we're going to go to the new Forbes list of billionaires around the world and hear who's on that list this year out. But I want to get one more call first. We heard from truck driver Jeff in Buffalo, New York. Now we've got hedge fund manager Phil calling from Boston. Hi, Phil. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I'm pretty good. What do you see?
So one problem I have is I think the angle, what you got, I understand that the journal's point is trying to, you know, catch headlines or whatever, and you got to make the difference in tax rates dramatic. But when you guys...
Well, we don't have to make it. I mean, it is dramatic, right?
It is, but when you're saying the 18%, I think the real important point there is the percent of that, I believe you attributed 60% being driven by the capital gains rate at which they're paying, because their effective income tax that they're paying is probably north of, you know, I'm getting what, you know, somewhere between 35% and 40%.
Right. So,
and
so guys like you, hedge fund managers, are going to make a lot more in capital gains, but net, it's coming out in this top 400 group to an 18% rate. You're saying what? That's okay because capital gains is the heart of it.
No. Actually, I think most of the gains, like for example, from my example, I think actually most of the, if you actually really got into it, most of the capital gains are short terms. They're actually taxed at your income rate anyway for the hedge fund guys.
Okay.
So like Jeff Bezos or like Buffett, for a lot
Amazon,
of these guys,
yep.
in that 400 list, right? They're going to have just created, you know, they're going to get that one time hit and then their annualized hit, but they've created a company and that's going to be taxed. Right when they go public or whatever have you, that's going to be taxed, but they're going to create these huge companies, and that's going to be your capital gains tax that's going to drag down their rate down to that 18%. So
where are you going with that, Phil? As a hedge fund manager, do things look just fine to you? You're a hedge fund manager and an American. We're looking at the whole picture. How's it look?
No, well, the way I look at it is a couple ways. Like I view it as. The capital gains tax to me is probably about right, but I can see that going higher, and I'm fine with that. I actually do a lot of charitable stuff, and I think if you looked at that list, there's tons of money coming out from charity on an absolute dollar base, and as a percent of income, especially for that upper 400. Now, I'm not there by any means, but I'm just saying in general. And then I also think it gets dangerous, though, like, you know, turning the politics a little bit. Like, I was looking at, like, I'm a Democrat, but I was starting to look at, like, Obama's plan. I'm slightly worried about if you look at some of his effective tax rates, where they potentially would put you, it's up to like on the income tax rate, with a bump in payroll tax, it would take you up to about 48% to 49%. And I think that goes over the bounds of saying, okay, we got to tax the rich more, but taking them down, you know, giving half your money to government, I just don't think is the answer. So it's a real balance. And I'm torn. Like, I got to admit, I'm torn, but I recognize you can't have this great disparity. I think you need to cast in the right light, and that 18%, I just don't think captures it. Exactly.
Well, it's the net at the end of the day, but there's some subtlety in there. We take your point, Phil, hedge fund manager. Phil, thanks for calling. Robert Frank, first to you on this charity point. Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, others have put a lot of money into charity, but does charity begin to, you know, sort of make a dent in the tax scale terms we're talking here?
Charity is important. Last year, the wealthy and the non-wealthy contributed $300 billion to charity, and that's a record amount, and that's important. But, you know, we have to decide as a country whether we want our infrastructure and education system and healthcare system funded by at-will gifts by the wealthy, or do we want government to make those decisions? And that's a larger debate, because those who support philanthropy and argue, as the caller did, that, well, they, you know, they make a lot of money, but they give a lot away. You know, the question is the government a better director of that money than the individuals? And some would argue the individuals, the causes that the wealthy support, you know, universities, hospitals, that sort of thing, may not benefit everyone. And so that's the argument against it.
We'll look more at who's proposing what. Oh, Michael, yes, please.
Tom, if you look at the charitable contributions of this group, it's about $7.6 billion, $7.5 billion out of $85 billion of total income.
In so it's 400, a little less. In the 400 biggest earners.
In the 400 earners, the 400 we've been looking at. So it's about 9%. So they're giving about 9% of their money to charity. You know, even the Bible suggests 10% for all of us. So it's not like on average this group is extraordinarily generous. Warren Buffett and Bill Gates, of course, have been extraordinarily generous to charities, but that doesn't mean that the group on an average is giving such a generous amount to charity.
Michael, Robert, stand by. I'm chomping at the bit to go global just a little bit here to put some planetary perspective on this. To do that, we're joined from New York by Matthew Miller, associate editor at Forbes magazine. He edits the Forbes World's Billionaires list. It was published yesterday. He also publishes the Forbes 400, which came out last fall. But Matthew Miller, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about this list. Who's on it? What kind of – I see Warren Buffett sitting right here at number one.
Right.
Bill Gates down at number three. I recognize a few other names here, but a whole lot of these I know nothing about. Yeah. Who makes the world's billionaires list, and how do Americans stack up on it?
Well, America still dominates the world when it comes to global wealth, but we're seeing tremendous rises. Americans, if you look at the number of billionaires, there's 1,125 billionaires in the world. Americans make up 469 of those, so that's 42%. Americans control 37% of the total cumulative wealth of all those billionaires, 1.6 billion of 4.4 billion. But what we're seeing is major rises in Russia, in China, in India, not only in terms of the number of billionaires, but also the people who are skewing towards the top of the list. If you looked at the world's billionaires about 2 or 3 years ago, half of the top 20 were Americans. Now that is dwindled down to four, and you have Indians, Russians, and Western Europeans taking up those spots. So you are seeing when it comes to the super, super wealthy, it going overseas.
Introduce us to a few of the overseas billionaires toward the top of your list here, Matt.
Sure. So the second richest man in the world and someone who's been vying for the title of world's richest man is Carlos Slim. He's a Mexican telecom mogul. He's worth $60 billion right there between Warren Buffett and Bill Gates. He essentially owns most of the telecom industry in Mexico. You have Lakshmi Mittal. He is the world's biggest steel tycoon. He lives in London, but he's an Indian citizen. He's worth $45 billion and controls about 10% of the crude steel market in the country. And then you have Mukesh Ambani, who is the fifth richest man in the world, worth $43 billion. And he is the largest largest stakeholder in a company called Reliance Industries, which is a petrochemical company in Asia.
Okay, so they're up there pretty high, way up in the 43, 50, $60 billion range.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of Americans thinking with our deficit, war costs and all the rest about who pays what to support the life of the nation. Do you have a sense of in these other countries where these billions have been made? Are these people paying more or less? Do you even know, Matt?
Well, it skews all across the board because you, in some countries you have relatively little taxes, but in a lot of countries you pay a lot. The thing about our lists, both the Forbes 400 and the World's Billionaires list, is we're looking at net worth. We're not looking at taxable income, which is what we've been talking about on the Fortunate 400 list from the IRS. And so most of these stakes are holdings in private companies and large resources, including oil, steel, but, you know, private equity and hedge fund managers as well. And so those guys have a lot of earnings. But most of the fortunes that we're talking about here are large pieces of massive assets and companies.
Okay, we've got questions on the global picture and the national picture. Let's get one from Denver, Colorado. Joe, you're on the air with Matt Miller, Robert Frank, and Michael Gratz. Hi, Joe.
Tom, hi. At the end of your last program, Katrina VandenHeuvel said that she believes that there's the largest redistribution of wealth going on right now in the world, and I didn't really get a chance to, or she didn't really comment on that at length, but it sounded like she's saying that it's going from America abroad, and I'm just wondering if we could present that to the panel and see what their thoughts are. And, you know, I'm a young kid coming up in America. Does that mean in 20, 30 years from now, the picture is still going to be the same? We're still going to have this huge gap in the super rich and people, ordinary people like myself?
Good questions, Joe. This was the editor and publisher of The Nation magazine, Michael Robert Matthew, who was with us in our last hour, Katrina VandenHeuvel, talking about redistribution. I guess, Matt, let's come first to you because you do the Forbes 400 plus this global list. I mean, do you look at do you track the bigger numbers? Do you have a sense of is wealth being redistributed out of the United States? Within the United States, is it getting less equitably distributed? I guess all the numbers have shown that the answer to that's yes recently.
Right. I mean, yes, there's certainly a wealth gap that is growing, and you can look at a number of data that will support that. But I don't think that necessarily that we're seeing all of this wealth flee overseas. We found 77 billionaires, new billionaires in the United States year over year, March to March. So we're certainly seeing a lot of billionaires, and half of those came from private equity and hedge funds. It remains remains to be seen whether those guys will still be billionaires next year. But, you know, Robert made a good point early in the program that a lot of their investments are going overseas, and so you have American billionaires making plays against the dollar or just taking their personal cash and taking it overseas, and I see that as a trend. But in terms of the ability of entrepreneurs here in the United States to try and achieve billionaire status, I don't see that dwindling anytime soon.
Robert Frank, when you went out for your book Richest Man and looked at the rich world, is it a different world in this country in terms of distribution than it was, I don't know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago? Joe says he's a young guy, sort of looking at the big picture. Do we have a different skew to where wealth and income are now than we did?
We certainly do. In the U.S., we have much more of a sort of winner-take-all society. And what you really have to follow here are financial markets. Financial markets, this huge amount of capital that's flowing around the world, is the thing that's creating all this wealth. And so in the U.S., people who start companies and tap into that financial markets by selling them or doing an IPO are making a bundle. But what's also happening because of those financial markets is that more and more money is moving into emerging markets like India, China, Brazil, Russia. Those are the places where all this capital is flowing in the past 2 or 3 years. And so if you look in the future, where are the millionaires and billionaires going to be created? We'll still have growth in the U.S., but more and more of the growth will be in these emerging markets. And I think more and more of the Forbes list will be populated by people in China, Russia, and Brazil, because simply that's where the investment dollars and the stock markets are going up at a much faster rate than the U.S.
And Michael Gratz, talk about the trend lines in the United States for our caller Joe in Denver. When you look forward, let's say what it may be in his lifetime, look forward 20, 30 years, can we see the sort of less equal distribution of wealth and income in this country? Can it continue on the kind of trend it's been on? Is there some natural limitation to that, or will we see even greater concentration of wealth?
Well, I think the internationalization of the economy, along with the technological advances that enable money to move around the world the way it does, have huge implications for the distribution of wealth in the United States. I think we're going to see continued pressure on wages of the ordinary people in the United States as they're competing with companies and people around the world. And I think our tax system really has to become modern for this new world. We've got a tax system that was fashioned after the Second World War when we had all the money there was and the rest of the world was trying to rebuild. And that's not the case anymore. And we need a system that will promote American economic growth that will be fair to the American people, taking into account the international tax system. That's what I'm trying to do in my book, 100 Million Unnecessary Returns.
Yeah, let me try and get one more call in a moment here. Let's go to Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Colin. Colin, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, when I hear all these numbers, I have to tell you, I get so infuriated. It seems it's just obscene, unethical, and unfair that people can make so much money. I feel like there really should be, caps on income. Like, you just can't make more than a certain amount. Who needs to make so much money? How do countries like other countries in Europe, like Norway, they seem to have very high tax rates, and people are fine there, and the countries are doing okay, and they're not going into the sewer or the gutter because of their high tax rates.
Colin, let us pick it up. Michael Gratz, it looks obscene to caller Colin, and he says, let's just put a cap on there. What do you say?
Well, I'm a capitalist like many of the other callers, and I believe that people ought to be able to make what they can make. But I do think we need a tax system that taxes them appropriately on earnings of this size. And even of slightly lesser size. I do think it's important that we keep in mind that you really can't design a system for 135 million tax returns, which is what we now have, based on looking at just this 400. We have to have a system that works for everybody. But these numbers are really troubling.
Matt Miller, you've got the global picture. If there's a sea change, is it toward more equity or toward more, money flowing to the top? And does the United States, to our caller Colin's point, do we look like an outlier here? Does our tax system look more or less effective than what you see elsewhere around the world?
Well, first of all, I'm going to continue to hammer home the capitalism point and that everyone has an absolute right to go out and stake their claim in the world and to be an entrepreneur. And if you have to
remember, Forbes, after all, we got that.
Take it past that a little bit, okay? You have to remember that Steve Jobs created the iPod and made millions of people happy, and he got rich off doing it. But you know, even though his biggest stake is in Disney,
absolutely. We got 20 seconds. What do you say, Matt?
I think that, you know, overseas you're actually seeing more concentration of wealth. Look in Russia, okay? Those people, the 87 billionaires that Russia has, they're the ones who are probably not paying very much taxes, and they control a lot more of the resources. So I do not think this is just an American problem.
Global context for a national conversation. We're not finished with it. We'll keep track of it right here and how it plays into the campaign. I want to thank each of you for being with us today. Matthew Miller, Associate Editor at Forbes Magazine. Thank you very much, Matthew, for being with us.
My pleasure.
Robert Frank, author of Richestan at the Wall Street Journal. Robert, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
And Michael Gratz at Yale Law School. Professor Gratz, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.